through it with authenticity and coming out the other end. So thank y'all very much.
Our program continues with session 3, Empathy and Vulnerability with Brené Brown.
We left off in the last session talking about empathy and shame resilience. And what I'd like to do as we come back is jump back in there and do something I don't get the opportunity to do very often, which is really deeply drop into some of the empathy work. Because I think it's key. It is, as I mentioned earlier, the antidote to shame. And I'm not sure, I know that before I did this research, I did not fully understand empathy and its complexities and what it was and what it was not. So what I'd like to do is drop into it a little bit more and talk about empathy. The one thing I would like to share is I do this kind of visual routine to explain the power of empathy with shame that involves a petri dish. If you put shame in a petri dish, it only needs 3 things to grow exponentially. Secrecy, silence, and judgment. If you take shame in the petri dish and you douse it with a little secrecy, a little silence, and a little judgment, it will grow exponentially. It will creep into every corner and crevice of our lives. It is the exact perfect environment for shame. If, on the other hand, you take shame and you put it in a petri dish and you douse it with empathy, when that happens, you've created a hostile environment for shame. Shame cannot grow, nor can it thrive in an environment of empathy, which is why we're really talking about it so much right now. So we talked about the 4 elements of shame resilience being, first and foremost, to know what shame is and to know that you're in it and what triggered it, to kind of reality check the expectations that drive shame for us. I call that element of shame resilience practicing critical awareness, because it's really about consciousness raising. I'll speak to women first. There are a lot of us who wake up every morning, stand in front of the mirror and go, old, fat, tired, ugly, everything that a $60 billion industry is counting on us saying. You know, you realize that if we woke up in the morning, all of us collectively, if we woke up every morning and looked in the mirror and said, oh my God, awesome. That entire industries would collapse. Like an economist back in, probably early 2000s, made a prediction. No, it was after 9/11, because they made a prediction that if every woman in the U.S. and Canada alone gave up all beauty and diet products for a week, that we would have industry collapse that mirrored the airline collapse after 9/11. That the entire world economy would shift. So there are a lot of people literally banking on us feeling pretty crappy, right? And so critical awareness, our reality checking the expectations and the myths that fuel shame, is about standing in front of the mirror and saying, no, 46, pretty great, this is it, and not today. Yeah, I'm not going to do it today. You know, for women, shame is, if shame comes over me, it's going to feel the same for me as it does if it comes over a man. That warm wash of smallness and inadequacy is the same. But the expectations and messages that fuel shame are organized by gender. For women, the number one driver of shame still to this date, and no, we have not come a long way, comma, baby, is appearance and body image. For women, shame is about doing it perfectly. Do it all, do it perfectly, and look smoking hot while you're doing it. For men, there are not a lot of competing and conflicting expectations. There's one. Do not be perceived as what? Weak. Right. Don't be perceived as weak. And that is an absolute straitjacket for men. It's crushing. And so to reality check that, I have a great story in Daring Greatly that I write about from a man who went through an intensive. I have a curriculum that I wrote, and so therapists and coaches and folks from all over the country are facilitating this curriculum. And a man went through the curriculum, and he said, you know, it really changed my life in the way I look at things, but I never thought it would play out like this at work. He's actually the COO for a large company. And they were in the middle of major layoffs, and it was his job to lay off some of the senior people. And he said at one point, the CEO of the company walked in and he was in tears, were just kind of streaming down his face. And he said, God, this is really tough. And the CEO looked at him and goes, Jesus, man up. We got a lot more to go. And he said, because I had gone through that shame resilience work, I was able to reality check that message very quickly. And I just looked at him, and he's my boss. And I said, let me explain something to you. If I can't cry when I'm firing people that I've worked with for 15 years, I've gone to their kids' weddings, their parents' funerals, then you've got the wrong person in this office. Get the F out of my office. So first we have to know that we're in shame. We have to know what it is. Then we have to be able to reality check those gender-based drivers. Then we have to reach out and share our story and speak shame. When we reach out and share our story, we need to make sure, and this is so important to me, that we choose people who've earned the right to hear our story. People who've earned the right to hear our story. You know, one of the things, like when I thought it was just me came out, we got calls from some of the big, kind of, I guess, daytime talk shows that were like, hey, bring some people on that have major shame and then have them tell their shame story. And then you can weigh in like as the talking, you know, expert person. I'm like, have you read the book? They're like, oh no, we don't read them. We get thousands of those. I'm like, yeah, no. We need to share with people who've earned the right to hear our story. We need to share with people with whom we have a relationship that can bear the weight of the story. Does that make sense? Because if we share with someone, and it's hard because sometimes when we're dying to tell these stories, and it's important, right? We talked about earlier, we either own our story or we stand outside of our story and hustle for our worthiness. Here's the magic about owning. Like, I feel like this is like a secret that people don't know, like you and me, and that's it. When you own your story, here's the power of that. You get to write the ending. You know, you get to write the ending of the story when you own it. So when you say, yes, this happened to me, but I own this story and here's how this story is going to end. You become not the subject of the story, but you're the narrator of the story. It becomes your story. And you get to write. And it was horrible. And I was in lots of pain. And I didn't want to leave the house for, you know, 3 weeks. And I picked fights with my boyfriend because I thought, how could you really love me? But then I got help and I realized that we all have this and that I'm absolutely lovable, imperfect, but totally lovable. And this is how the story ends. Does that make sense? But you don't get to write the ending if you don't own the story. And so part of owning the story is sharing it and reaching out for empathy. So what is empathy? I love this work from Teresa Wiseman, and she is a nursing scholar in the UK. And one of the things that's really different about grounded theory is that you don't do a lit review before you do the research. So in traditional research, you do this huge lit review, and then you go and do the research. You do a lit review to figure out what's missing in the literature. What do people know and what don't they know? Well, in grounded theory, you don't care what people know. Because you're not building on any existing theory. You're building a theory based on people's lived experiences. And grounded theory methodologists don't want you getting your mind full of crap from the literature, which may or may not be true. They want you to interview people and talk about their lived experiences. Then when you're done, you go into the literature and say, where does it fit? Where does it match up? That's where I found the Stone Center from Wellesley when I was explaining the strategies for disconnection, moving away, moving toward, moving against. This is when I ran into Teresa Wiseman's work, and she took empathy and she studied empathy across every discipline and profession where empathy is relevant, medicine, nursing, faith communities, and came up with 4 qualities of empathy. And I think they're worth the discussion because empathy is so incredibly powerful. So the first one is to be able to see the world as others see it. Now, one of the things I learned when I looked at Wiseman's work is that empathy combines really four huge honkin', as we would say in Texas, skill sets. This is not for the faint of heart. So the first one is to be able to see the world as others see it. That's called perspective taking. That is, if you share a story with me, I don't want to weigh in from my experience. I want to hear it from your experience. One of the dangers, I think, about perspective taking, and it's a skill set. Let me tell you how it's often taught. Those of us who are raised with it get it from our parents. That's the most common way we get it. Do we have perspective taking modeled? I would say in this culture, I see very few families teaching perspective taking. Because what perspective taking is it is about understanding someone's experience through their lens. And there's a mythology, I think, in counseling programs and social work programs, psychiatry, psychology programs, that if Joe comes in and shares one of his struggles with me, my job is to put down my lens and pick up his lens and try to see his struggle. Well, our lenses are like soldered to our faces. They are our age, our socioeconomics, are we straight, are we GLBT, are we questioning, our class, our life experiences. So our lenses are very fixed to us. The key is that when Joe tells me his story, if I really want to try to understand his experience, I have to acknowledge what my lens is and acknowledge that it's not the lens, but a lens. And that Joe also has a lens that's as valid and true as mine. So if he comes in and says, I mean, this is a great example. I forgot a client's name at work. And in the middle of a big pitch, I called him Joseph and his name was Thomas. And I go, oh my God, that's not a big deal. I do that all the time. Which is true. I do that all the time. Is that empathic?
No.
Right. Because through my lens, it may look one way, but what he's seeing in his experience is something else. So this whole idea of perspective taking, and it's learned, and I got to tell you this, honestly, the whiter, more middle class, educated, and Judeo-Christian you are, the less likely it was modeled to you growing up. Because we were raised in a culture where our lens was the lens, the dominant lens. We still have that lens. It's very rare for me to interview someone who's African-American, Asian-American, Latino, Latina, who was not raised with a keen sense of critical awareness, because that's survival. An example from someone I just recently interviewed around critical awareness said, I'm keenly aware of other people's perspectives, because I grew up in a household where my mother would walk by and say, ain't no black folks on that program. And so I became very aware of what I was watching and what I was seeing and where I was going and how people were communicating. When we're part of dominant culture, we don't really see that very often, right? It's just not something we do. So it's something that a lot of us have to practice more. The parenting. How many of you in here are parents? So the majority. Empathy is really tough with our children. Because their perspectives are so different and their worlds are so much different. So, you know, we have our fifth grader who comes home and says, my locker assignment completely sucks. And anyway, so I'm next to Jose and Jose has been really nice, but Susan's next to Jose and then I can't even do that. And she was like dropping my books and it's a 45-minute dissertation on this. And what we're thinking is, did my mammogram come back? Susan's intervention is tomorrow. I need to be there. She's really relapsing. I'm going to talk to my sister. Do they think my dad's memory is as bad as I do? Are we going to be able to pay the mortgage next month? I'm really, you know, that's what's going through our mind while what we're hearing is, anyway, it's the locker didn't even shut. And I tried to put my math book in there and it fell out. And I was like so totally embarrassed. It rolled. But that's their world, right? That's where they live. And so is it empathic to look and say, look, I'm trying to figure out how we're going to keep our house. And your Aunt Susan's gone off the rails with her prescription drugs again. This is a very small problem that you have. Is that empathy? No. It's not. But is it seductive to do?
Yes.
Oh my God, yes. Okay, so that's not empathy. So empathy is about perspective taking. What's your world? What does this mean to you in your world? The second one, to be non-judgmental. Empathy only happens if we stay out of judgment. So how many of you enjoy judging? How many of you are fairly good at it? I can nail you by your shoes. So if you enjoy judging and you don't want to give it up, put your fingers in your ears and do like that na-na-na-na thing here, because I'm going to be the complete judgment buzzkill right now. Because we know why we judge. We have pretty good data that speak to why we judge. Here's why and how we judge. We always judge in areas where we are vulnerable to shame. And then we always pick people who are doing worse than we're doing. It's confirmation. So if we're standing with a group of friends and someone walks by and we go, Jesus, does she have a mirror? Has she seen her ass in these jeans? Wow. Wow. But happens about 6,000 times a minute in every country around the world. Right? It's the culture we live in. So the bottom line is, if you feel good about your own butt and your own jeans, you don't make that comment. We judge in areas where we are the most susceptible to shame, because what we're anxiously looking for is validation that at least we're better than you. So if you think about the areas where you're the most judgmental, it's probably a great sign, or is a great sign, that that's where you're also the most vulnerable to shame. That's why parenting, audible sighs, like, parenting is a judgment minefield. Because every one of us who's actively engaged in doing it, we're keenly aware that we're screwing it up all the time. So if we can walk by someone who's really screwing it up, it's so much fun to walk by and go, oh, Jesus. You know, because it feels so good in that 1 minute. So to be non-judgmental, to understand another person's feelings and to communicate our understanding of that person's feelings. This is what's very interesting and very subtle about empathy. In MSW programs, Master Social Work programs, we teach empathy. And we divide it into a skill set that looks very much like this. And then you get break into dyads or, you know, pairs. And then you get like a scenario. And then you practice with each other. And it's very horrible to watch for first year students. Because it looks a lot like, Mr. Smith, I see you are so sad. I am sad with you, Mr. Smith, and I am conveying that sadness to you. Yeah, that's what it looks like. It's very awkward, and it feels very step by step. But empathy is very subtle, and one of the reasons I, you know, often talk about empathy as sometimes just a glance. Have you ever been in that situation where you're in shame and someone just looks at you? And immediately you're like, they get it. Because in a glance or in a look, they can convey, I get what you're feeling. I'm not judging you. I'm here with you. One of the most interesting studies, we were talking about this earlier, one of the most interesting studies that has come out recently is about how for some people who I think probably are overusing Botox, they're seeing a marked decrease in measurable empathy. Yeah, and I thought, Steve and I talk about this kind of anecdotally all the time because we live in a community where there's a lot of it. And sometimes I'll say, man, I was with so-and-so and I told her the story about what happened with Charlie at school and she seemed super disinterested. And Steve's like, oh, yeah, that's new. I think that's Botox. She's really doing that now a lot. And to me, it really spoke. And then a study came out, sure enough, confirming this, that sometimes it's just the ability to look at somebody in the eye and reflect back in our face what they are saying in their words. Does that make sense? And so we have to be really careful about that. And that's like if someone's ever telling you a story, I do this with my kids all the time. If, you know, Charlie's telling a story about something, you know, I told a knock-knock joke and no one laughed with me, but everyone laughed at me and they said I forgot it. And I'm driving, you know, I'll either pull over or I'll stop and take my sunglasses off and look at him, because we can convey so much. I mean, the two most important words we can hear when we're struggling are "me too." Like, I get it. And one of the questions I'm asked often is, what about if I haven't had that experience? Well, I can tell you a story from a couple years ago, and it's a great illustrative story about empathy. I was in the kitchen unloading the dishwasher, and the phone rang, and it was a friend of mine, newly divorced. Not divorced yet, but newly separated. Her husband texted her that he was leaving her on a business trip and let her know in the text that he was madly in love with one of his colleagues who was also on the business trip. And she had 3 kids under 4, including a newborn. Yeah. I'm trying to be mellow, but I'm thinking special place in hell. But I'm trying to be mellow. Okay. So I'm sure there's an empathic story on his side too. I'm sure there is, but that was the story. So she called me and she was crying. I said, "What's wrong?" And she said that she had just grabbed her toddler and shaken him until he was like afraid of her. And the more afraid of her he became, the more powerful and better she felt. And so this is why empathy is not a default response. Because I'm just unloading the dishwasher, minding my own business. And empathy requires us to go into a place where we can connect emotionally with that feeling. So I have one of two responses that my default responses would have been one of two things. You've got to stop doing that. You've really got to stop. I know you're angry. I know you're heartbroken. I know you're scared. You've got to stop taking out on your kids. Empathic? Kids are better, safer when she gets off the phone, or less? Less. Total judgment, right? Or I could have said this: it's fine. Kids are super resilient. You're having a hard time. That's code for, I'm not going here with you, right? So empathy requires me to go to that dark, terrible place where I understand the capacity for that, where I understand what that feels like. The truth is, I've never done that, but I have never been in her situation either, ever. And I've done lots of other things that I'm sure other people have not done, I'm very sure. But I haven't done that. But let me tell you something. I have had to walk out of a room and physically separate myself from my kids when I've been overwhelmed. And so I just had to say to her, "I get it." And she said, "You've done it?" She calls me out. And I said, "I haven't, but I've done plenty of things that were not being the mother I want to be and the mother I know I can be. You are in a very difficult situation. And when I'm backed up against the wall, none of us are our best selves, especially our best parents. I get it." So empathy is not the default. And this is when I should bring in this definition from Pema Chodron that is one of my all-time favorite definitions in the world. Here's what she says about compassion. And I think this is very true of empathy. And although I think empathy and compassion are different things, I think empathy is a skill set. I can think compassion, to me, is a deeply held spiritual belief about how we live. I think it's making a spiritual commitment to empathy. But she says compassion is knowing our darkness well enough that we can sit in the dark with others, and that it is never a relationship between the wounded and the healed. It is a relationship between equals. No one reaches out to you for compassion or empathy so you can teach them how to behave better. They reach out to us because they believe in our capacity to know our darkness well enough to sit in the dark with them. Does that make sense? And what we have a tendency to do is we have a tendency to flip on the lights. It's no big deal. It's not a big deal at all. I get it. We all lose our temper. It happens. Is that sitting in the dark? No. So empathy is not the default response. And to go through these, you know, to take her perspective, to stay out of judgment, to try to get into what she's feeling and communicate that I get it, is work, and it's a commitment. And it's, again, we have to be mindful about it. So when we share and when we ask for empathy, and people ask me all the time, can you practice self-empathy as a way to get out of shame? We're going to talk about self-compassion in a later session, specifically Kristen Neff's work, who I think she does beautiful work around self-compassion. I have to tell you that it is my opinion that shame is a social construct. It happens between people and it heals between people. And while self-empathy is an incredibly important place to start, we need to tell the story. And we need to be in relationship with someone who can hear it and confirm that we're lovable. You know, in terms of self-empathy, when we're in the middle of shame, my first rule when I'm in shame is to talk to myself the way I would talk to someone I love, which we don't do very often. If Ellen did something that was shaming, I would look at her and say, sweetie, you're human. We all make mistakes. I make mistakes. You make mistakes. I don't love you despite those mistakes. I love you because of them, because you're real and you, and we'll figure this out together. Could you imagine talking to yourself like that? And it makes us giggle, right? But if we go back to that definition of love from the very first session, we can't love people more than we love ourselves. And I'm not sure that we can extend compassion to other people beyond what we extend it to ourselves. Empathy versus sympathy. While empathy is the antidote to shame, sympathy is the shame amplifier. How many of you in the throes of a shame spiral would like for someone to look at you and go, you poor thing. I feel so sorry for you. Empathy is feeling with, sympathy is feeling for. The best story I can tell you about sympathy and empathy is from, I thought it was just me, because it's just a classic story. That when, and it was to happen years ago, because Ellen was in a day school at the university where I teach. My husband called it the school for little communists. It was like a human development lab school where they, I'm sure, did all kinds of experiments on our kids, but it was very Piagetian, and it was very, you know, they had all these rules and community, and it was great. So it was the end of the semester, which was always a very difficult time for me because I've got grades due and there's graduation and all kinds of stress around that. And then Ellen's got her teacher appreciation week and on and on. So I go to pick up Ellen from school, and I knew it was her end of school party. And when I go pick her up, the sign up sheet for the party is still hanging on the front door where it said, Brené Brown, 3 dozen chocolate chip cookies. Well, I didn't bring cookies that day, and there were very few people signed up for dessert beside me, because apparently I was feeling extremely ambitious that I was not going to just bring chocolate chip cookies. I designated 3 dozen chocolate chip cookies. And I was like, oh my God. Oh my God. How am I going to do this? So I thought, I'm going to sneak in and get Ellen and sneak out before anyone sees me. Which is not something you want to happen. You don't want you to be able to get in and get your 4-year-old without people seeing. So I walk in and I come face to face with Ellen's teacher. Okay. So instead of saying, like, normally, oh my God, I hope the party was fun. I completely forgot to drop the cookies off. And then she probably would have said, no big deal. We had a great time, blah, blah, blah. I go, how was the party? And she goes, look, people can't even make eye contact with me right now. I was, how was the party? She said, it was great. I said, and I looked over and I saw the spread, and I was like, how were the cookies? I know. And she kind of turned around. She goes, they were great. I said, oh, good. I'm so glad they were. I just kept going. All right. I'm so glad you enjoyed them. You know, I know. It was a very stressful time for me. And on the top of the last day of school, the next day was commencement, and the students had asked me to speak at the commencement address, do the commencement address, which was a really big honor, but it was Ellen's first ballet recital, so all 8 of her grandparents were in town for it, half of which were staying at our house. You know, it was just crazy. And so I get Ellen, I get in the car, I'm in a total shame spiral. Like, not only did I not bring the cookies, I just lied to the teacher, to the Montessori human development teacher, who was probably thinking, that was a bad choice, you know. I get in the car, I start crying, Ellen's like, what's wrong? I'm like, that's it! I get home, I call my friend, my poor friends, it is Dawn, and she's like, hey, what's up? I'm like, oh my God. I just totally lied to Ellen's teacher. I stole someone else's cookies. I said they were my cookies. She's like, what kind of cookies? And I was like, this is not like a joke. This is like serious. And I'm in a total shame spiral. She's like, okay, I'm sorry. She's like, what's going on? And I was like, I was supposed to bring the cookies. I didn't bring the cookies. Then I lied about them and I asked how they tasted. And she goes, oh, okay. And then this was the best thing ever. She said, we can do this. Which was so great, right? And I'm like, okay. She's like, you're probably going to have to talk to the teacher at some point. I said, okay. Did you do it in front of Ellen? I was like, I did. She's like, yeah. So you'll have to talk to her too, but that's all right. Cause it'll be a great like learning moment. And I said, okay. And she said, but first we have to talk about you. And I was like, oh, okay. And she said, you're going into a nearly impossible weekend. I said, what do you mean? She said, you're giving the commencement address. Ellen's got her ballet recital. The chances of you making it there are slim to none. And I know you think you will, but you're probably not going to. And you have 4 sets of parents. Are they all talking right now? I said, yeah. And she said, okay. It's going to be pretty half-ass all weekend. I said, it can't be. And she's like, no, it's going to be. And so you're going to have to recalibrate. I was like, what do you mean? She's like, you're just going to have to put your best foot forward, be yourself, and let all this stuff go. You're going to have a very, very imperfect, messy weekend. And you're not going to be able to be there for everybody and be what everybody expects. That's unacceptable. And she said, I know, but that's what it's going to look like. So what do we need to do to get you ready for that? And I was like, why? And she said, because you're off to a rocky start. And then I started laughing. And then she said, okay. So she said, let's go through the timeline for Saturday. Let's talk about what's reasonable. You know, she's a therapist, have I mentioned this? Which is awesome and a pain in the ass. So that was empathy, right? We can do this. Like, God, isn't that awesome? Let's fast forward to Steve and I have some new best friends. I'm convinced that this couple is going to be our new best friends, that she and I are going to do everything together and that they're going to do everything together and that we're going to grow old together and play bridge. And I don't really know them that well, but it was that kind of romancy beginning of a friendship that I thought it would be great. So we go out to dinner for the first time and we're talking and I go in for the absolute premature vulnerability move. They were talking about the last day of school and she says, swear, I was so astonished at how many people brought store-bought goodies for the last day of school. And so my immediate scarcity thinking is, oh my God, if I can get her approval with my story. So I'm like, store-bought goodies. Let me tell you about the goodies on the last day of school. And I look over and Steve's going like this. Shaking his head. Like, don't do it, man. Don't do it. So I said, I forgot to bring cookies. And then I told the teacher that I had brought them. I claimed someone else's cookies and then asked them how they tasted. And I thought we were going to laugh and like, woohoo, I'm with you. What can we do about it? You know, we're together. In unison, she and her husband go like this. I'm not exaggerating. Oh my God. They put their hands over their mouth and just went, ugh. I just feel it. And then she said, I'm so sorry. You know how like when you start to tell a story and it's going to be funny, but then you realize it's not going to be funny and you have to wind it up really quick. I was like, no, no, it's good. No. She's like, no, really. Are you going to pull her out of that school? I was like, what do you mean? She's like, I couldn't go back. That empathy? I'm so sorry for you. And then actually says, I can't imagine doing that. So here's the difference between sympathy and empathy. I always talk about empathy as a sacred space, this round sacred space. And so what happens is we've got a friend who's down in this hole and we walk to the edge of the hole and we go, hey, are you okay in there? No, I'm really struggling. Let me be with you. And so what we do is we lower ourselves in the hole, but we never lower ourselves in the hole unless we know how to get back out. And we take with us some skills that they're not having down there, some perspective or whatever it is that they need. And then we both get out. Once you jump in with the person and then you're down there mired too and you can't get out, that's not empathy. That's over-identifying. That's enmeshment. That's a lot of things, but it's not empathy. Like then you got two people in the hole. What good is that, right? Empathy is, I get it. I'll be in there with you, but it's not my hole. Sympathy is when you walk up to the edge of the hole and you say, what happened? And they say, something really bad happened. You say, that's terrible. No way in hell am I going in there. I feel bad for you from up here where people don't do that kind of stuff. That's sympathy. Sympathy is I feel bad for you, not I feel with you. Does that make sense? And sympathy without question exacerbates shame. But empathy is not the default. Compassion is not the default. It's a decision to be with people in a very hard position. And it requires vulnerability. So we're back where we started. Are y'all ready to talk about vulnerability? Okay. So what we've talked about so far is that vulnerability, we think of it as the center of these dark emotions. We think about it as a center of shame, fear, uncertainty, disappointment, grief. But what we're starting to understand is it's also the center and the birthplace of love, belonging, empathy, innovation, creativity, authenticity, accountability, adaptability. So for us to really get our heads and hearts around vulnerability, what we need to do is we need to talk about some of the myths around vulnerability. The biggest being that vulnerability is what? That vulnerability is weakness. That vulnerability is somehow almost a character defect. When we asked people, what is vulnerability? We got answers that we did not even expect. Because we asked them for specific examples of what is something vulnerable that you've done? What is an example of vulnerability? So people said things like this. Vulnerability is asking for help. Vulnerability is saying, I don't know. Vulnerability is sitting with my wife trying to make decisions about our kids. She has stage 4 breast cancer. Vulnerability is calling a good friend whose child was killed in a car accident. Vulnerability is loving someone who struggles with addiction. Vulnerability is getting promoted and not being sure that I'm up for it. Vulnerability is getting fired. Vulnerability is initiating sex with my wife. Vulnerability is initiating sex with my husband. Vulnerability is sending my child to school knowing that they're struggling, but knowing I need to let them do their thing. Vulnerability is taking responsibility for a mistake. What I would ask you is, in what example is vulnerability weakness? How many of you have had to make one of those very difficult calls to someone who's just gone through something really tragic? What do? We circle the phone for an hour. We think, nah, I'll call tomorrow. It's probably not a good day. In fact, I shouldn't call at all. Maybe I'll send a card. Maybe I'll just bring a casserole. I'll slow down, have the kids drop it off at the front door. Right? The vulnerability of calling and knowing there's nothing you can say to make this better. Except that I'm with you. And I know that there's nothing I can do to make it better, but I want to be with you in the shittiness that cannot be made better. You know, how is that weakness? How is showing up like that and being present with people weakness? It's not. I'm telling you, if there's one thing I've learned, it is that vulnerability is our most accurate measure of courage. To be vulnerable, to let ourselves be seen, incredibly, incredibly difficult. There's two big myths. I'm going to talk about four myths, but the big two are vulnerability is weakness, and I don't do vulnerability. And it's normally followed up by a gender comment or a professional comment. I don't do vulnerability, I'm a dude. I don't do vulnerability, I'm a lawyer. I don't do vulnerability, I'm an engineer. You know, I get it. None of us are comfortable with vulnerability. I'm not comfortable with vulnerability. We've talked about this. Y'all know. I'm not comfortable with it. But here's the thing. If vulnerability is defined as uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure, you do vulnerability every single day. Every single day. Love. How many of you love somebody? Honestly. Hands across the room. Everyone loves someone. How many of you have control over whether that person loves you back? Whether they're safe right now? Whether they'll love you tomorrow? Every time we wake up and love someone, it's a huge act of vulnerability. It is a major part of showing up and letting ourselves be seen. I'm a big Rush fan, the band Rush. clarification. No, I am a big Rush band fan. And they have this great lyric from their song Free Will that says, when you choose not to decide, you still have made a choice. And that's very much like vulnerability. You can say that you don't, you know, you can say I don't do vulnerability, but you're still making a choice. And the choice that you're making is that you're going to let vulnerability do you. You're going to let vulnerability choose what you're going to do. Because you're going to do it. You're going to come up against it. What do you do with it? And we'll go through what people do with it when they don't walk into it, engage with it. The third myth is that we can go it alone. That we can create a culture in our family and our work and our big culture that we live in even. And that we can do this alone. Doing things on our own, not asking for help, is a huge value in our culture. You cannot do vulnerability alone. You cannot try it on, see how it feels, attempt to be vulnerable in new ways without a support system. We have to have people around us who we can look at and say, you know, and it's not, it doesn't have to be cryptic. It doesn't have to be, I'm going to try this new thing and see how they respond. You can say, look, I've been thinking a lot about vulnerability. I read a book. I heard a talk. And I want us to try to be more vulnerable and real with each other. And I'm scared about it. And are you in? I mean, vulnerability is basically, in poker terms, being all in. It's much more courageous than holding your life close to your chest and not letting people see you. And we can't do it alone. And there's an irony about vulnerability that is, I think, profound, but also tough. It's a tough is the only word I can come up with. It's just heart-wrenching a little bit. And that reality is that most of us growing up, as we experience pain and shame and struggle with worthiness, we shut down parts of ourselves. And we shut down those things that make us vulnerable. And we say, I'm not going to put myself back out here anymore like this. It hurts too much. I'm not going to get all excited about drama club and run into the house and tell my parents because they think drama club's goofy. Or I'm not going to tell my dad that I really want to quit the football team and I really want to be president of the Klingon Society. you know, or I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to start shutting these parts of myself off because it hurts too much. And we really see this happening around middle school. This is where kids really start shutting down parts of themselves. And the heart-wrenching kind of tough irony is that this is what I think being an adult is. We grow up, and around middle age, late 30s through maybe 60, we realize that to be the parents, partners, people, professionals that we want to be, we have to open up all those places that we shut down. Otherwise, we will never have access to all the things that we want and deserve. And there's something very heart-wrenching about that, because we shut those things down because it hurt. It's a house, and we're born, and all the windows are open, and there's amazing breezes flowing in and out, and it's just great. And there's security. There's supposed to be security and a roof over our head. But things start blowing in and blowing out, and maybe the people even under the roof start perpetuating hurt because of their own hurt and their own brokenness. And we start shutting those windows. And then we wake up one day, you know, and we're my age, or, you know, for me, this all started to unravel around 41. And we realize that we're suffocating, that everything's shut down, and we're safe, but we're miserable. And then it's not as easy. How many of you have ever lived in an old house? It's not as easy as walking over and flipping the windows open, right? Because they've been painted over like 46 times. And this is like the chisel work. You got to figure out, why did we close them? What hurt? And then coming into the realization that we're adults now. And the things that were said to us or not said to us or done to us or not done to us, we can protect ourselves against now. We can walk away from. We can walk toward. And so I think one of the hardest parts about vulnerability is the idea that so much of what I see missing in our lives today is because we are shut down from vulnerability. We are just not open to feeling. We're not open to the risk. So first myth is that vulnerability is weakness. The second myth is that we can choose not to do vulnerability. The third weak is that we can go it alone. And that's, how many of you struggle with the go it alone thing? Oh my God. Any White Snake fans? Come on. Don't be embarrassed. Hear that song? Here I go again on my own. Like, I hear that song, I'm like, yes! You know, my husband's like, are you okay? I'm like, I'm alone on the lonely street of dreams. You know, I've got kids in the back seat, soccer balls. He's like, right on. Yeah. But we have this whole American cultural, like, I can do this alone. And we cannot. I mean, I think one of the most profound moments for me in the middle of kind of my breakdown spiritual awakening, that year that I spent kind of trying to live the data rather than sort the data, happened when I was with Steve, and we were in Port Aransas, which is like a beach community in Texas. We were in Port Aransas, and Ellen was, okay, let me do the math. If I was 41, she was 7. And she used to do this dance, and it was like this real crazy dance that she would do, and not the least bit self-conscious or anything. You know how kids are great at that. And I was watching her, and Steve and I were laying on the floor, and she was dancing for us, and I got really emotional and cry. And I said, it's like she does that, and it's so, like, brave, and she just does it. And I love her even more. It's like she's vulnerable, and I love her even more because she's vulnerable like that. And Steve looked at me, and he said, I love you like that. And I said, what do you mean? He's like, when you're goofy and you make mistakes and you screw things up or you do something really weird, I love you more. And it was the first time in my life that I even knew or understood that another adult could love another adult, not despite their vulnerabilities, but because of them. You know, and I don't think we live in a culture like that. And I don't even think we let ourselves be like that with our partners. I come home from work with one set of armor on, and I put on another set of armor at home. And I think we all do that. But I think I know that worthiness is a birthright. That we have the right to be goofy and awkward and imperfect and be loved even more for that. So that was like 4 or 5 years ago since I came to the end of that really hard period. I'm still working on it all the time. But it's been amazing to me how the transformation, even in our marriage, where he's so much more willing to come home and say, I screwed something up at work, or I will say, you know, it used to be like if I got a bad review on Amazon or somebody was critical in a comment that, you know, if I wrote something on a blog post for Huffington Post or something, the people I loved would be the last people I wanted to see it. Like I would be ashamed more for my friends and like Steve to see it, because I'm thinking, oh man, the gig is up. They're going to know I suck and they're going to be out of here. You know, and now to have this life where I can, that can happen and I can go, he'll be like, do you want me to kill him? I'm like, you know, that I can go and be just totally imperfect. And I think we don't do that with each other. You know, one of the biggest, there's a lot of tensions and a lot of paradoxes with vulnerability. And I think one of the big ones is, it's the first thing I look for in you, but it's the last thing I want you to see in me. In you, it's courage. In me, it's inadequacy. In you, it's strength and lovability. In me, it's shame. You know, how many of you, I mean, I asked this at the TED conference this year. It was the first time I've ever been to like to the big TED. Do y'all know what TED is? So it's a big conference where they bring in thought leaders to talk for 18 minutes. And TEDx Houston was a smaller venue, and then the big TED is in Long Beach. And so I got asked to close the big TED this year, which was a huge honor, very stressful. And so one of the things I said during that talk, which I didn't mean to say at all, which I really didn't, because I don't ever plan my talks. Like I don't have notes beyond what you see up here, because that means I'm not paying attention to you. Because like if I put something up there and y'all are like, ah, this is crap, I don't understand it. And I'm like, well, that's too bad because I got another set of notes coming. But if I just do this, then I can just be with you where you are and we can move together. It was just the way I speak, which is great, but there's a lot of risk taking and vulnerability in it, as you can imagine. But one of the things that happened at TED was that I said during the TED talk that this is a failure conference. And I remember people were like, but here's why, because you have to understand, like TED is a weird place. Like Al Gore is sitting right next to me, Sandra Day O'Connor's behind me, the people who started Google are here, the people, you know, that's the people who go. It's a very curated kind of weird audience of successful, crazy people, I think. Not crazy, crazy successful people, not crazy comma, but every time we met somebody, within like 5 seconds, you'd be like, so, you know, what do you do? And they're like, oh, I've tanked the last three companies. I've got a really exciting venture going on here. We were waiting to get into the hall one day for the talks, and a guy walked up, and everyone's very friendly, and sat and looked at Steve and said, oh, you're a physician. What kind of medicine do you practice? And Steve said, I'm a pediatrician. And he said, I applied for medical school, but that's as far as I got. And it was kind of like this little bit of awkward moment until you look over on his badge, and it says, like, CEO of the App Store. You know, he did pretty well. He owns 14 pediatricians. But everyone was really comfortable with their failure. But one of the things I thought was interesting that I asked the audience during the talk is I said, how many of you, when you looked up on the stage and saw someone being very vulnerable and sharing stories, how many of you thought of that as courage? Every hand went up. And I said, how many of you think of vulnerability in yourself as weakness? And every hand went up. The last myth that I want to talk about with vulnerability, and it's kind of the last thing we'll go over today, is that if I were to ask you, I want you to go forth and be vulnerable. I want you to really practice vulnerability tonight with someone or tomorrow. What would be one of your first concerns that came up about being vulnerable with someone?
Rejection.
Being judged, rejection. Losing something.
I was planning to have fun tonight.
You were planning to have fun tonight. It's not synonymous with fun. I think it's so fun. So what all these answers come up to, minus fun, rejection, losing something, getting hurt, not being respected. What I think a lot of that boils down to is trust. There are trust issues around vulnerability, right? How do I trust you're going to get it? How do I trust I'm not going to lose something? How do I trust? And so when I was really getting into the trust literature, because I spoke with a congregation in Charlotte last year, and it was this incredibly moving experience. No, it was earlier this year. Really, this whole congregation wants to try to implement wholeheartedness as a congregation, Episcopal, and I'm Episcopalian, so I was at their church. And they're like, well, we don't know about this. I don't know, we trust each other enough. First, we have to trust each other. Then we can be vulnerable. So the myth is that you can trust without vulnerability. That you can set up some kind of litmus test that if you pass all these things, then I can trust you enough to be vulnerable with you. And it's a very chicken egg proposition. And the best way I think that I have found to describe it comes back from Ellen. When she was in second and third grade, she had a teacher, Miss Bauckham. And Miss Bauckham had a marble jar. And every time the class collectively made good choices, they would put marbles in the marble jar. And every time the class collectively made bad choices, i.e. substitutes, marbles would come out of the marble jar. And if and when the marble jar got to the top, she threw a party for the classroom. So it was called the marble jar. Well, Ellen comes home to me one day in third grade and is just sobbing after school. And she had confided a very embarrassing story to one of her girlfriends. And by the time recess was over, everyone knew. And she said, when she came home, I will never tell anybody anything about my life again. And so my response, it was the first time she'd ever had an experience with betrayal, right? And so my, of course, first response was like, hell no, you won't. That's exactly right. You know, lock and load. This is my job is to pass this down to the next generation. Generation number six. And so I said that, oh my God, that's really hard. And we talked about it and and she said, I don't understand. And I said, do you have friends who you've told things to before where they've really honored and respected your trust? You know, they held your stuff in a precious way. She's like, yeah. And I said, and I was trying to think about how do you explain trust to people? Trust is a really hard thing. And then I remembered the marble jar. And I said, trust is like a marble jar. It's not like I'm going to tell you something, the deepest, darkest secret of my life, and then see what happens. What's going to happen is I'm going to share small pieces of my life a little bit at a time with you. And I'm going to fill up that marble jar. And when that marble jar is full, that's what trust looks like. It happens over time. It happens slowly and it grows. And she goes, it was a great response. She goes, oh my God, I get that. I have marble jar friends. And I said, tell me about your marble jar friends. And so she told me about, Hannah and Lorna, and she told me about her marble jar friends. And I said, why do you trust them? And she said, because I've shared things with them that they have never shared with other people, even if it would make them more popular. And I said, that's a big one. And she said, and when the popular kids ask them to sit with them at lunch, they only will do it if they can take me, and if they can't, they sit with me. I was like, that's it. And I said, and what are some of the things that they do that you feel like are adding marbles to the marble jar? And I thought her answers were so brilliant because they lined up exactly with John Gottman's research on trust and betrayal. She said, they're small things. And I said, like what? And she said, they have their moms call you when I don't go to school to see if I'm okay. They know that my grandparents are Oma and Opa. And they'll say, oh, are you going to be at Oma's house tonight? They know if Charlie's sick, her little brother. And I thought, that's what trust looks like. John Gottman tells a story when he writes, and he's an incredible relationship researcher whose work is, I think, profoundly important. But when he tells a story about trust with his partner, and he said that he was really excited about finishing a mystery novel that he was reading. And he said that he went to the bathroom to brush his teeth and he was just super anxious to get back into bed and finish this novel. And when he walked into the bathroom, his wife was kind of standing in front of the mirror and looked really sad. And he said, and there was just this moment where I was like, I don't even want to ask. I just want to brush my teeth and read, find out who killed who in this book, right? And he said, but those he